Welcome to JGL Law for You. This podcast is sponsored by Joseph Greenwald & Lake, a suburban Maryland law firm that has been representing clients throughout the D.C. metropolitan area and across the country for close to 50 years. JGL Law for You is a podcast by lawyers, but not for lawyers only. On JGL Law for You, we will bring you up close and personal with our lawyers and some special guests who will be discussing how to navigate the many legal processes, developments in the law, other current events, and how they may affect you, your family, or your business. Today, we're talking with JGL's own Matthew Bryant in the area of will contests. Matthew is a litigator in JGL's civil litigation group. He has a special interest in fiduciary litigation, such as will contests, trust disputes, and disputes over the uses of financial powers of attorney. Before joining Joseph Greenwald & Lake in 2010, Matt served as a law clerk both at the circuit and appellate court levels. Welcome aboard, Matt. Thanks for coming.
Thanks for having me, David. I appreciate it.
So this is a very interesting area, I think, for all of us, because all of us, if we haven't already, at some point in our lives, we're going to be faced with a family member or friend passing away. And I assume where there's money, that gives rise sometimes to disagreements between folks, right?
Absolutely. And this is, you know, Maryland has a process for contesting wills and to making sure that if there's questions about whether or not something happened that was improper regarding a will, to make sure that people and beneficiaries have the opportunity to challenge it so that the decedents or the person who passed away, that their wishes are fulfilled as to where their property should go.
Got it. So let's walk through that process. All right. And let's start with, I might as well start at the beginning. So I come to you, there's an issue that arose with my mother's will or my father's will or my spouse's will, whatever it may be, or a friend. What happens first? What do you do as my counsel? What do you do first?
So the first question is going to look at is, well, has an estate already been opened up? And so we'll go on the Register of Wills website and determine whether or not an estate has been opened up. And so maybe at times there's already been an estate has been opened up, meaning that the probate process has begun and a will has been filed with the Register of Wills and a personal representative has been appointed, meaning the person who is going to act to affirmatively probate the will. Or sometimes maybe that's not the case, but you're aware of a will that you have concerns about, or for some reason you or someone else would not believe that it actually reflects the testator's desires, the person who's passed away, their desires as to what happens with the property.
Matt, when you say probate the will, for folks out there listening, what does that mean exactly?
Yeah, so a petition would be filed in the Register of Wills. So, if, for example, in Prince George's County, that would be in the courthouse in Upper Marlboro. There'd be paperwork that would be filed along with the will in order to begin the process of providing court supervision for the distribution and allocation of assets and paying off any debts of the person who passed away.
And that's a process that, although I assume it's different from potentially one county to the next, but also is a process that's followed in states, not just Maryland, but the District of Columbia and Tennessee and Montana as well, for that matter, right?
Yep, that's correct.
Okay. So let's say you want to challenge or you have an issue with the will or you believe that something was done improperly. What do you do? Where do you file your challenge and what do you say?
Yeah. So, you know, the first thing is, you know, you're going to look at the will and figure out kind of some first immediate questions you have is, who prepared this will? Is this a will that was written on a napkin or that purports to be written on a napkin or on a piece of paper? Or is this a will that was prepared by an attorney in a law office? And these things are always very important because, you know, when there's an attorney preparing a will, there's going to be, you know, certain assumptions which may or may not be correct, but there's more kind of time and focus dedicated to the process as opposed to something that's not the case. So, but the first thing we want to look at is who prepared it and kind of what are the concerns about the will? But there's some things about kind of challenging that you need to act very quickly. As one of my colleagues said, the rules of probate are set up for speed and for a good reason, right? You know, no one wants to have kind of if they're a beneficiary, to have the funds of their passed away relative being tied up forever. And so there's a real hard line about to file what's called a caveat, which is kind of a Maryland term that's used for the challenge to the will. The will contest is called a petition to caveat. And there's a 6 months rule, so it needs to be filed very quickly. And that 6 months runs from the time that the personal representative is appointed. So from the time that the will is filed with the Register of Wills, ordinarily there's a very, very quick turnaround time to the appointment of the personal representative. And from that time, in Maryland, people receive what are called letters of administration. So it's really 6 months from the time that the letters of administration appointing the PR are issued to file that the will contest, or what we refer to caveat is like the legal terminology for the challenge.
So those letters are issued in Maryland anyway by the probate court. Is that right?
By the Register of Wills.
The Register of Wills. Okay. And those letters, what do they say?
It's very brief in terms of just, it's basically 8.5 by 11 sheet of paper. They'll issue a couple copies of them and identify the personal representative to the estate of the decedent.
And what's the purpose of having those letters? What does the personal representative then do with those letters once he or she gets them?
Yeah, so for a personal representative, it would provide them with proof of what their authority is to act on behalf of the decedent's estate. So it allows them to act. You know, for a person who's interested in challenging a will, they may not have copies of those documents, but they can go on the Register of Wills website and determine whether or not in a PR, kind of what the status of it is. So you could search by a decedent by name and determine who the person is and what kind of the status of the probating the will, where it is in the process.
So let's talk about challenging a will. What are the most frequent or regular grounds, at least in the jurisdictions that you practice, for looking to the possibility of challenging someone's will?
Yeah, so there's kind of a couple different categories of ways that you would challenge this. The first is kind of, does the document that's been filed as a will, does it satisfy the legal formalities of a will? So is it A, is it in writing? B, is it signed by the person whose will it is? And three, is it signed by two or more witnesses in the presence of the person who signed the will? And so ordinarily, those kind of formalities, Maryland lawyers refer to it as whether there's due execution, whether it's properly executed. So that'd be the first one. You know, maybe the will, the witnesses didn't sign in the presence of the decedent. Maybe there's an allegation that the decedent actually didn't sign the will and it was not the person's intention that the will be signed. So those are kind of one, whether it's properly executed. Proper execution, actually, sometimes attorneys videotape will signings. And if that evidence is out there, it's very important to get that for challenging a will, because sometimes the video evidence will show that there were errors in terms of the execution of the will. It's important to get that in order to determine if there's video evidence to determine exactly what happened.
Why would a lawyer videotape his or her client execute? I mean, just to step back a little bit, his or her client executing a will?
I think that they'd want to use it in the event that it's challenged to show that it was done properly.
I see.
And sometimes it may show that it wasn't done properly at all, though.
And are those, I don't want to focus too much on the videotape, but does that happen more frequently where a lawyer has a client and there is concern that maybe later or more a heightened concern of the potential for challenging the will?
So I think less frequently are things videotaped as opposed to concerns about the person's kind of cognitive abilities or kind of they have the wherewithal to actually do it. And that kind of dovetails into another way that a will can be challenged is based on testamentary capacity, meaning did they have the cognitive wherewithal in order to sign the will in the first place, or did they suffer from what Maryland case law referred to as an insane delusion, which are distinct problems with will signings, but they're related. You know, with testamentary capacity, you know, the test for the court is, you know, did the person understand the nature of the business in which they were engaged? I mean, did they understand they were actually signing a will which was giving their property to another when they pass away? Did they understand what their property, generally the nature of what the property was? Were they aware that did they think they only had $10, or were they aware that they had $10 million? So these kind of questions as to the nature of the property. And the third is, were they aware of the people who had relative claims to the property? So the potential beneficiaries, and this is why medical records in these types of cases are just very, very, very important. So, was a person suffering from dementia? Was it a mild dementia? Was it a severe dementia? These kind of questions are just critical in terms of being able to examine whether or not what that person's state of mind was, whatever that date was, you know. And there's other types of red flags too, right? So what was the nature of the change, right? Did a person on the eve of their death sign a will that gave everything to a nurse in the room? Or was it something that happened 10 years earlier? And was it done in a law office? Was it done in a hospital bed? Kind of the circumstances surrounding execution of the will are highly important. And so, you know, one of the things that, you know, medical experts are very important in doing this. So gerontologists or forensic psychiatrists will be people who will go through and be able to help looking at medical records. And the other thing that's important is kind of the nature of the medical records. Do we have appointments seeing kind of people who are expressing opinions or have notes about kind of where that person was in the world in terms of their cognitive abilities close to the date of the will execution? Is it 10 months apart on either side, which gives you this vast gulf? And those are things where experts, you know, will likely be battling about if the person's cognitive abilities are like kind of in a contested area. Sometimes people are so gone that you know, they're suffering from some kind of disease that it's irreversible. And so you just see a progressive decline. So, but those are kind of some of the issues that you find in testamentary capacity cases. So medical records and medical experts are key in those types of cases.
And what's the nature of the burden for the individual who's challenging the will under this sort of insane delusion theory, for lack of a better word? You know, is it I have to prove that my Uncle Joe was suffering from dementia beyond a reasonable doubt, or is it some other level of proof?
Yeah, so it's going to be a preponderance of the evidence standard that's going to apply, and that will even apply. There's some appellate case law about applications of fraud in this context, but in the caveat in the will context, it would still be a preponderance of the evidence. But that burden would be borne by the person who's challenging the will. So we're talking about in the will contest situation, to challenge that will, they need to do it by preponderance of the evidence, and that will be regardless of the ground in which you seek to challenge the will.
Okay, and for those of us out that are listening here and don't know what that means, what does a preponderance of the evidence mean?
Yeah, so it would just be more likely than not. So 51%, I guess, in a way, be able to convince either a judge or a jury, depending on whether or not you're in the orphan's court or whether or not you're in a circuit court. But by a preponderance of the evidence. And the other thing is, with respect to insane delusion, you know, one of the things you raised, that it's important to also note that it's not just that, you know, this person suffered from some kind of, you know, problem, but that the will was the product of that issue. So the fact that someone has some very unusual or eccentric beliefs will not be enough to kind of strike down that will. You need to have a nexus with the actual creation of the will.
Sure, they might have had those same eccentric beliefs when they were 19 and just out of high school, I suppose. So it's, right, everybody's a different bar, I guess, depends upon what the person is. I mean, what's crazy for me might not be all that unusual for you.
Yeah, every case is going to be different.
Okay. So let's talk a little bit about this undue influence theory, and what kind of cases do you see this more frequently in?
Yeah. So, you know, the undue influence cases are going to be looking at whether or not you have some kind of relationship ordinarily it's going to be some type of, the allegations are going to rise out of some person who has a very close relationship. And so most frequently this is going to be, you know, some kind of parent moves in with a child, and there may be allegations that, you know, the child sought to influence the parent to disinherit maybe a sibling or someone else. And those, I think, are the most kind of likely scenarios of the allegations of undue influence. And what we're talking about undue influence is we're really talking about a third party or a person who has influence on the person who's creating the will in a way to kind of, the allegation would be that they overrode that person's normal agency as to what they would ordinarily do with their will. And, you know, this is one where it's a very fact intensive. It's going to be looking at, you know, their relationship. You know, was it unusual as to what happened? You know, what was the relationship between the two? How close was it? You know, was there a history of estate planning that this constituted a radical change? A bunch of facts. These will be very factually intensive kind of inquiries as to whether or not some kind of improper influence was imposed on a person who passed away.
So let's shift the focus for a second to powers of attorney and trusts and legal disputes that arise as a result of someone potentially misusing one of those powers or not acting appropriately as trustee. What types of actions do you see, and how do they differ from what you just talked about when it comes to will disputes?
Yeah, so you know, I think one is this: the forum is going to be different, right? So will contests are going to start out in the Register of Wills, and then you'll be in the Orphan's Court, and then it may or may not get transmitted to the Circuit Court, and just kind of practical things in terms of kind of the procedure is different. Whereas, you know, if there's allegations of someone misusing a financial power of attorney, those are cases that are ordinarily going to be filed in the circuit court. And likewise with trust disputes, those will be filed in the circuit court. So, you know, I think one is just kind of the process in terms of how you get there. But in terms of kind of some of the discovery, it likely will be very similar. Another thing is just in terms of kind of like, if there's like a jury, the jury verdict sheets look very different. Whereas, you know, a will caveat's very much going to be focused on questions of was the will a product of fraud, as opposed to a trustee case, which will be more similar to other civil litigation where, you know, was there a breach of trust? There'll be allegations of damages. Same with power of attorneys. Did this person kind of breach their fiduciary duties, you know, kind of in a damages assessment like that? So that damages component is different than it is in the context of will contest. Another thing, there's another evidentiary distinction, is that the dead man statute, which is a statute of Maryland, which limits the ability for people to testify as to statements by the deceased person. Ordinarily, that will prohibit, unless it's been waived, statements about, you know, mom said this, mom referring to the deceased person. Whereas in will caveats, there's actually older case law that suggests or indicates that the dead man statute would not apply to will caveats. So there may be some evidentiary distinctions as well.
So I'm subject to a power of attorney. My attorney in fact, they're called, right, is doing things on my behalf for whatever reason he or she is doing them. And my, you know, a sibling or a spouse thinks that that is inappropriate, or they're doing something that they ought not be doing.
Right.
What does he or she do to try to further that claim or try to protect me in that situation?
Yeah. So, right. So a financial power of attorney would be a relationship between two people where certain powers are conferred over. So let's refer to them as like a principal and an agent. So the principal would give the agent, that is, you know, the person who has the authority to act on behalf of mom or dad. The concern becomes is that sometimes people use those as a personal slush fund, as opposed to respecting the fiduciary obligations. That person has a duty to act in the best interests of the person who gave them those authorities. And the court expects and sets very high standards to what those expectations are. So if in fact there's been financial improprieties, that a person has the ability to sue for damages to recover that those misappropriated or misspent funds if they cannot account for how those funds were spent. So, and sometimes these things happen, get uncovered very far down the road. And so, and sometimes those expenditures can be large ones, or sometimes they can be a series of small transactions.
Okay. Now, we hear this phrase, confidential relationship, and its involvement in these types of disputes. First of all, what does that mean, and what's the importance in looking at a claim similar to the ones that we've been talking about?
Yeah. So confidential relationship, under Maryland law, there's a term confidential relationship, which refers to a relationship between two people where there is trust, confidence, and reliance upon another for certain things. So, you know, an example would that be would be an elderly person has some person that they trust and they share their financial information with. They rely upon them to pay bills or to do certain things. And the law sets imposed burdens if that person who they rely upon is either alleged to have taken advantage or is suspected of taking advantage. And, you know, there's some interesting contrast. So in situations where the person is alive and let's say at the time and there are certain transactions that occur, let's say an elderly person signs a house over, just gives a house to someone else. Under Maryland law, what happens is the burden shifts to the person who receives the house to say, well, you know, is that a fair transaction? You know, and it puts it on the burden to receive it to show why this is a proper transaction the law should respect. You know, it's a really interesting contrast because in the situations, if someone creates a will and does that same transaction, that burden does not shift. And so, you know, one thing that's, you know, a big concern for attorneys is when you're examining this case is, well, you know, what is the burden of proof going to be? And so whether or not that the financial or the property transfer occurred during life or after life or through a will is a very important thing to determine who has the burden of proof to determine whether the transaction was improper or whether it was proper.
Now, when these cases end up in litigation, and you mentioned that sometimes they can be tried by a jury or tried by a judge. I imagine processes may be similar or different from state to state. But what's the frequency that these kind of disputes get resolved without there being trials? And why would that, happen?
Yeah, I mean, most cases don't go to trial. Most cases get resolved. And most courts have systems in place when these cases are in litigation to bring the parties to talk about whether there's a way to resolve these disputes short of a trial. You know, in these cases, oftentimes there are family members who have very tense and hard relationships or strained relationships, which makes it a little bit more difficult. But usually the mediation process is one where if the parties are so inclined to reach a resolution that they have the opportunity to do so. And a lot of times they do so recognizing that there may be risk on both sides in terms of proceeding to either a judge or a jury to make some of these decisions.
Very interesting. Well, Matt, I want to thank you so much for your time today. This has been really, really informative and interesting for folks. I'm sure we could talk for another 2 hours on this topic. If folks want to get hold of you, Matt, and talk about a concern they may have about this type of an issue or any type of litigated matter, what's the best way for them to get hold of you?
Yeah, they can give me a call at 240-553-1185, or they can shoot me an email. It's mbryant, B-R-Y-A-N-T, at jgllaw.com, or they can just Google Matthew M. Bryant at JGL to find me on the web. So thank you, David, for your time.
It's been terrific. Thanks to everyone out there for listening in. Hope you join us on our next episode. I'm David Bullitt, and this is JGL Law for You.